Now let us look at the Decalogue more closely for a moment. Every prohibition of God is for the health and eternal well-being of man. Mrs. White recorded in Redemption, Book 2, page 74. The Decalogue reveals and illustrates the principles of God's government, of love, of the gospel. The law is a transcript of God's character, Patriarchs and Prophets, page 52. The central theme of the Bible is the restoration in the human soul of the image of God. This is the burden of every book and every passage of the Bible. It is unfolded in many different ways. Education, page 125 and 126. God did not wish man blindly to submit. And in the scriptures, he appeals to his intelligence. He wishes man to observe the consequences of disregarding his 10 words and gives ample evidence of the futility and folly of breaking God's law. The Decalogue is a most spiritual revelation of the character of God. Let us look at each of the precepts briefly. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. God is the husband of the church. Isaiah 54, verse 5. He promises to give and in return requires absolute faithfulness. As in the home, both the husband and wife are one flesh. Only when each contributes all of his individual life to the other. So we must have no desire or ambition that is not of God. We cannot pull away from our earthly companions and maintain unity and accord. Neither can we pull away from the Lord and put in his place objects of affection that dethrone him from our hearts and remove him from the center of our lives. God has no plan for us but does not embrace our sharing his life. And so when he invites us to have no other gods before him, he assures us that he and he alone will ever be true and loyal to us. As the husband and the wife blend their individualities in each other, so God purposes that his faithful, obedient children shall blend themselves in him and share his nature. God invites us never to make any man-made representations of himself. Any idol, any image, any prop to worship is a mutilation and limitation of God. Christ is the only representation of God to the world. John 14, verse 9. He is to be a constantly growing image. He is a continually unfolding representation of infinite love, manifested in all his works. 1,000 generations is too short a time to grasp even the faintest glimpse of Christ's mercy, love, and grace. As we know Jesus better, our conception of God becomes more and more wonderful. Now to set up human devices, pictures, images, to represent the infinite is ruinous. And wherever idolatry is established in any form, wherever men look to the products of human art and skill as signposts pointing to God, the infinite, the all-wise, the ever-loving, there is ruination. The third commandment calls upon man never to take the name of God in vain. The name of God stands for his character, his glory. When Moses requested the Lord to be shown his glory, Jehovah promised to declare his name and gives to his honored servant a list of his characteristics. We are aware in the world today of the value of names. That's why some of them are so carefully copyrighted and their reputation cherished and guarded. A wife takes the name of her husband. We take the name of Christ, 1 Corinthians 12:12. If the wife fails to live up to the standards of the home, but does things that are dishonorable and disgraceful to her husband, the marriage relationship is marred, and she takes the name of her husband in vain. By carelessness, by unbecoming conduct, it may even be by words, carelessly or blasphemously spoken, we may drag Christ's name in the mire, give the lie to our profession, prove to the world that we neither love nor honor our Creator. The fourth commandment has some complex overtones. By it we acknowledge that we owe God our supreme allegiance, for He is our Creator. He made us in the beginning. He sustains us through the years. In Him we live and move and have our being. The Sabbath is then a memorial that God created. As we look at that creation, we discern that in its very orderly progression, recorded in Genesis chapter 1, God exhibits Himself as considerate and lovely. To give but one illustration, God did not create a butterfly until He had created a blossom. He loves and provides the ideal environment for the least of His creatures. When the 6 days' work of creation had been completed, God contemplated on the seventh all the aspects of His handiwork and was content in the fulfillment of His purpose. This is the meaning of rest, as it is suggested in other parts of the Scriptures. Let me call your attention to the well-known story of Ruth and her two daughters-in-law. Following the tragedy of the triple death in Moab, three widows mourned. After a time, Naomi said to her two Moabite daughters-in-law, "I plan to return to Bethlehem. You return to your families." They loved their mother-in-law, and so neither Orpah nor Ruth were prepared to go immediately. And then Naomi, as a further argument, informed them that she had no sons who might be their husbands. "Will I then find for you rest in the house of a husband?" she asks, meaning that the answer shall be no. The point I would stress is that she used rest to point up the fact that a wife's marriage was the fulfillment of her life. The same thought is brought to our notice in the third chapter of Ruth and the first verse. Jesus is the great bridegroom. The church is the bride. We find rest when we are joined with Christ in the marriage of the Lamb. The unrest of our lives, its frustrations, negations, its quests, its failures, all are satisfied in the intimate relationship of the soul with the Savior. As Jesus invited all, "Come unto me, and ye shall find rest unto your souls." God rested the seventh day, not because He was weary, but because He was fulfilled. He was satisfied. He had accomplished this stage of His creative activity, and behold, everything was very good. From the most minute insect to Adam and Eve, the crowning work of His creative skill. And so God rested the Sabbath day. And God blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. The Sabbath is a day that we should remember. It's a day that underlines the truth that as God was satisfied and fulfilled when He had created us, our fullest satisfaction and the fulfillment of our lives is reached only in complete worship of Him. God is ready not only in the daily blessings He gives to us to support us, but He blesses the Sabbath day. And upon this day, the memorial of His love, the golden clasp that binds us to Himself, that we are to remember, He is ready to give to us a Sabbath day blessing. This Sabbath day He calls the sign between Himself and His creatures. It is a sign, He promises, that He will purify, that He will make clean, that He will vindicate, that He will sanctify those who worship Him. Exodus 31:13 and Ezekiel 20:12. Sanctification is victorious living. The Sabbath is to be a sign or a seal that the God of creation is ready to give to us of His infinite power to fulfill this purpose in our lives. The Sabbath is to be a perpetual reminder of all these things that God created, that God is satisfied, that God is fulfilled, that God wishes us to be satisfied, wishes us to be fulfilled in worship and in union with Himself, and that He brings into it and in our worship of it and in our observance of it a blessing that will make it a golden clasp, a seal, a tie, a sign, the mark of sanctification between us and our Creator. These four commandments indicate man's duty to God, that He is the one who is supreme and worthy of all love and adoration. The second table of the Decalogue covers man's relationship to his fellow men. This relationship, of course, grows out of man's worship of his Creator. First of all, God bids us honor our earthly parents. The child receives his life and all the material blessings from his parents. He owes to them when they fulfill for him God's purpose in family life, all the blessings that come. His parents stand to him in the place of God. Honor, love, respect to his parents, therefore, is incumbent upon him. This presupposes that the parents will be worthy of honor. Should the fifth commandment be carried out perfectly, the hearts of the fathers would be turned to the children, and the hearts of the children would be united with their parents. Next comes the sixth commandment, Thou shalt not kill. The most sacred trust given to man is life. To take life is to take from man the most important gift he has. Life comes from God. Man must not take from his fellow man this life. Being God's property, being made in His image, we should not violate this relationship by thinking even derisively of another. You will recollect Christ warned us not to call our fellow men fools or worthless wretches. Matthew 5:21-22. The killing of the physical man may be harmful, but the slaying of the spiritual man may be even far worse. This can be done by criticism, by scorn, by slander. Against this Jesus warned in the Sermon on the Mount. Terrible are the consequences, both in this life and in the life to come, for such a disregard of the sixth commandment. Both physical and spiritual killing grows out of a lack of love. And this is the very antithesis of God. The devil is the murderer from the beginning. Christ, the great lover of our souls, is the creator and the restorer. If by words, by acts, by thoughtlessness, we deprive another of the fullness of life, we are siding with the murderer. If by our words, by our acts, by our contribution to the well-being and the fuller life of our fellow men, we keep the sixth commandment, we prove by this that we are on the side of Christ, the great restorer. The seventh commandment is, thou shalt not commit adultery. In the scriptures, this term is used not only of the relationship of a husband and wife, but also of the relationship of God's people to Christ. Christ is the husband of the church. We find this in many parts of the scriptures. Other sins may bring small physical deformity, but adultery blasts the whole life, the mind, the physical features, the health, while gnawing like a cancer at the very soul. Adultery produces diseases extremely contagious and incurable. Adultery is an illustration of the leprosy of spiritual sin, which afflicts our souls if we play false to Christ as our heavenly husband. Spiritual adultery produces diseases as contagious as physical and as incurable. Ezekiel 16:15-59, Romans 1:29. This commandment, therefore, calls upon men to maintain loyalty, cleanness, perfection in the intimate relationships of this life and also in relationship with Christ, the groomsman. Husband and wife, created to live together in purity and in affection, must permit nothing to break this relationship or to mar the harmony that should exist. This may be done even in the realm of the mind. On the Sermon on the Mount, Christ showed that while the letter, thou shalt not commit adultery, might be kept, the spirit of this commandment goes far wider. The lustful look, the yearning desire uncontrolled, these are adulterous and defile the soul. The eighth commandment deals with man's property. Thou shalt not steal. The fundamental principle of love is sacrificial giving, freely, voluntarily, continually. The opposite of this is selfish greed. Robbing takes by force that which exalts or pleases self, robbing man of his time, reputation, character, or possession, merely trains us to take from God these very things: time, talents, health, affections that he has lent us to use for him. Let us look to Christ. Though he counted it not a prize to be grasped at, to be on an equality with God, emptied himself and gave us so bountifully that it could not be said of him that he could give more. This same principle he wishes we should manifest in our relationships. He illustrated this too. If someone takes from you your coat, give, he says. This principle pervades many Old Testament regulations. In the law of the sabbatical year, in the law of the Jubilee, God wished to underline methods by which grasping greed might be removed from the lives and characters of his people. We are to give rather than to seek to get. The ninth commandment has to do with truth. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Truth is an attribute of God. Of the scriptures we are told, thy word is truth. The devil is a liar. He negates truth. From Lucifer in heaven to the most insignificant gossiper, Satan's traffic in ruined souls is maintained through false witnessing. In heaven, Satan bore false witness to the character of the Creator. He seduced a third of the angelic hosts. By our false witness here on earth, we are doing the work of Satan and following his footsteps. To be generous of the opinions of others, to be kindly in estimating their dealings and their motives and the attitudes of their lives, we show the kindness and toleration and generosity of God. Actually, it is pride that lies at the basis of all lying. Humility is the essence of godliness. Truth, like the other principles of the moral law, finds its foundation in love. To love is to be generous and truthful. Give the benefit of the doubt when the facts are not fully known. And the facts are not fully known most of the time. The tenth commandment covers the realm of the mind. Thou shalt not covet. Coveting is the inordinate desire for what is possessed by somebody else. Covetousness was the festering canker that ate its way into Lucifer's heart. Covetousness produced the flood of woe and sin now existing. Lucifer inordinately desired the position and power and prerogative possessed by Jesus himself. The wanting of things that are legitimate may be perfectly right and proper. I may want a nice, shiny car. I see yours, and it raises in me a desire, and I decide to save up my money and buy the sort of car you have. This may be perfectly right and proper. Where covetousness comes in is when I desire your automobile. As young people grow up into manhood, they want to establish homes of their own. The young man wants a wife. There is nothing wrong in his desiring a wife and a companion with whom to share his life. Covetousness enters when he wants somebody else's wife. As heirs of God's promise, we shall inherit all things. But the Spirit of Christ provides these wonders for us, that we may become rich. The spirit of Satan covets all. It wants what belongs to somebody else. It reaches out for that which is not our own. It ends in negation, in misery, and death. In Jesus Christ, we can obtain joy and gladness. He is ready to give it to us. And this we gain by seeking to enrich others and give them the blessings that he has shared with us. This attitude of selfless giving negatives the principles of envy in our own lives. Giving is the principle of heaven. Getting, wanting what is not our own is the destructive force of Satan. These 10 precepts then cover all man's relationship to God and all man's relationships to his fellow men. There is no relationship that is not covered by these 10 precepts. And as we have already noted, in the judgments given by God to Moses, we are granted illustrations and applications of these great principles for our guidance and for our blessing. May I repeat? God put these Ten Commandments on two tables of stone, imperishable stone, written by his finger, so that none may make mistakes, none may misconstrue or misunderstand the principles of his government. These were laid in the ark. They formed the basis of the ark, the foundation of the government of God, the foundation of his justice, of his decisions, of his purposes for vindicating man and condemning sinners. The Ten Commandments, then, are God's pointers to conduct in all of life for all men in every age. Now let us note the significance of Aaron's resurrected rod. Moses encountered Jesus at the burning bush. He had been a shepherd in Midian for 40 years, following his flocks from one watered wadi to another. He suddenly saw in his journeyings this strange sight. With his rod in his hand, he approached until ordered to stop. The divine voice reminded him that the place upon which he stood was holy ground. And there, Jesus, in one of the strangest manifestations of the Old Testament, spoke with his chosen leader and revealed the glories of redemption. The burning bush speaks of the incarnation. Desire of Ages, page 23. In the incarnation, the glory of Almighty God dwelt in a tiny earthly body and did not destroy it. In the flaming bush, the same glory dwelt in a tiny shrub and failed to consume it. Fire, the enemy of wood, only made that bush a tree of light. As God encouraged Moses, he worked a miracle with his rod. The shepherd was commanded to throw it on the ground. It became immediately a snake. Then the voice said, "Catch it by the tail and lift it up." To those who know snakes and the poison of this adder, that was an act of faith. Instead of catching it back of its venomed fangs, Moses was told to catch it by its tail. But he believed, and seizing it, found he had the rod again in his hand. With this rod, he was to work miracles. We see him then before Pharaoh, again making his rod a serpent, but a serpent that devoured the make-believe serpents of the magicians of Egypt. We watch this rod strike the ground, strike the river, lift it up into the air, bring one plague after another. As the children of Israel journeyed from Egypt, they came at last to a place between two mountains facing the Red Sea. By Jehovah's command, Moses again upraised his rod. And this time, by its authority, a way across the sea was made. The rod of the shepherd had become almost the scepter of a mighty king. In the wilderness, the people lacked water. Again, the rod was used. This time, it smote the rock, and from it opened the fountain that saved the lives of the millions of Israel. The rod is emblem of the Son of God, and so is the rock. The rod smote the rock, dimly pointing to the great truth that no man smote Christ to death. He laid down his life. He took it up. Himself the rod, himself the rock. When Amalek fought, the rod upraised was signal for victory. Pointing up to the heavens, it showed the fighting armies of Israel the source of their power. The rod of Moses had become the rod of God, the sign of power and majesty.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.